Okay, I would like to welcome you all to this first session of the 13 Principles. These 13 principles are of such critical significance to the faith of the Jew that one might legitimately ask why it is that we didn't do a class such as this a long time ago. It's really the foundation of everything that takes place in the life of a Jew. Part of the answer to that is that these principles of faith and their explication, their explanation, their the exposition of them is very complicated, has some very sensitive and delicate demands that it makes on our understanding and intellect, and the complexity of them demands to some extent that we take into account the intellect of every individual, the personality of every individual to whom we are addressing the explanation of these things, and see to it that we leave no molecule of misunderstanding. To misunderstand the basics of the faith, to have a muddled or twisted view of them, is a very sensitive and dangerous dangerous matter, because it really affects the entirety of everything that we do and the way in which we relate throughout our religious experience to the divine being. So it's I've been somewhat reluctant to do that, because I don't believe that this is really the ideal context. Which then raises the question, so why are we doing it now? I just made a fairly good argument about why it should not be done other than in circumstances which are relatively contained. The fact is that there are a great many misconceptions and a lack of appreciation for the basics of the faith, to the point where it becomes increasingly unlikely that we're going to reach all the people that we need to reach and have the kinds of intense sessions that these things require. So, for want of a better forum, we end up doing these things publicly, but I would like to invite all of you, by reason of what I said initially, that if there are matters which somehow remain unclear, that you contact me or one of the other kollel rabbis, Rabbi Ben Sion, or someone else whom you know to be knowledgeable about these things, so that you can clear up whatever remains somehow not totally focused in your mind. These are not things that you can allow to linger without clarity. The first of the animamins deals with the fact that there is a creator. With the course of time, we may be able to get into such things why these specific 13 principles were chosen as opposed to more or less. There are other statements about what makes up the essence that is requisite of every Jew in order to be able to be defined as a Jew. The Sefer HaIkrim from Rabbi Yosef Albo manages to condense these 13 principles of faith into three, taking many of them and showing how that they are really subsections of a larger principle rather than independent principles. And there's a great deal of discussion and at times some questioning about whether or not it is possible for an individual to be an intact religious believing Jew without having all of these principles in place. Let's, for the purposes of today's session, I would be grateful if we could define the first two words. Ani mami, I believe. We will find that those two words are very important words, that we need to have a very precise definition of what I means and what believe means. For example, the word believe might mean, to some, a leap of faith. And many are under the impression that all religious experience ultimately is reduced to the kinds of things which are not capable of being demonstrated, and since one cannot demonstrate them, therefore you are forced to take a leap of faith. There is a, for example, one of the individual who is considered the father of existentialistic philosophy, Soren Kierkegaard, was someone who believed, he was a religious Christian. I'm not sure of which denomination, but he was a Christian by faith. And he believed that Christianity was absurd. Now that confronted him with a problem which would not release him from its clutches. Namely, how are you religious when you're confronted by a premise which is absurd? And I think that the basic, as I recall, that the basic premise which he found to be absurd was this concept of the Trinity. How can something be both one and three at the same time? Whatever the case, and whatever it was that troubled him, Kierkegaard believed Christianity to be absurd and insisted that the only way in which one could resolve this absurdity was by a leap of faith. In a certain sense, you had to close your eyes and you had to walk off the cliff. Or I believe he used the image of someone suspended over 20,000 fathoms of water without any support. Is this the way in which we would define the word, I believe? In other words, is the Jew compelled to believe in these many things that the Rambam, that Maimonides sets forth in these 13 principles of faith in that fashion? Do we believe in them without grounds, without support, without reason? Do we close our eyes and say, I believe? Why do I believe? I don't have the foggiest idea why I believe. Because somebody tells me that this is what I have to believe in order to be Jewish. That this is what I must believe in order that I might have a portion in eternity. In order that I might legitimately call myself a member of the children of Israel. Is that the way in which we understand I believe? At the same time, if we argue and we say, no, that's not what the word I believe means, then does it mean I know? Because I have such compelling evidence that I know in much the same way that I know that this is a table. But we don't say, I believe this is a table. We say, I know this is a table. And here we do use the word, I believe. So why is it that we use that word believe if we are so convinced? There is, in fact, somewhat of an absurdity in these two words, I believe, especially as it relates to some of these principles which make up the first part of the 13 principles. If we define our terms carefully, then what we are saying is, I, who have a finite mind, believe that there is an infinite God. And if we bring those two terms in juxtaposition to one another, we have to ask ourselves, so where is the point of nexus? Where do these two concepts allow for any kind of contact and intersection? Where is it possible for the infinite to come in contact with the finite? Why does it make a difference that I, who am finite, believe in the infinite? Is it possible for the finite to address the infinite? Or conversely, is it possible for the infinite to address the finite, or to have any interest in that which is finite? As it will be, as will emerge from this discussion, one of the things that we will present is the fact that our faith draws upon precisely such a contact in which the finite and the infinite, that man and God, intersected, where there was a encounter. And is that not absurd? How is it possible for us to make such a statement? There is a an exposition of the basics of our faith, which is the author of which is Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato. It's called Derech Hashem, the Way of God. And he begins by saying as follows: every Jew must know and believe. Now he uses two words there. Every Jew must know and believe. So there are two movements of the intellect: knowing and believing. Every Jew must know and believe. Actually, in the Hebrew, it reads Tzorich Sheyamin V'Yeda. It's in the reverse order. Every Jew must believe and know that there exists a first being who is infinite, without beginning or end, who brought all things into existence and continues to sustain them. This being is God. It is furthermore necessary to know that God's true nature, and we're going to come back to this, cannot be understood at all by any being other than himself. In other words, the infinite is the only one who can know the infinite. It's impossible for anyone other than God to know God. The only thing that we know about him is that he is perfect in every possible way and devoid of every conceivable deficiency. These things are known by transmission from our forebears and the prophets. With the revelation at Sinai, all Israel perceived them and gained a clear grasp of their true nature. They then taught them to their children, generation after generation, until this very day. As Moses commanded them, you shall not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, and you shall make them known to your children and to your children's children. These concepts can also be logically verified by demonstrable proofs. Their veracity can be demonstrated from what we observe in nature and its phenomena. Through such scientific disciplines as physics and astronomy, certain basic principles can be derived, and on the basis of these, clear evidence for these concepts deduced. So, Lutzato is telling us that we can arrive at these conclusions by logical and philosophical means, but that we know them not on the basis of philosophy or logic, we know them by tradition. The Sefer HaBris, which was written a number of centuries ago by an author in Vilna, I believe it was Vilna, identifies seven sources of information. That is, seven ways in which we gather information for our use. One is what he calls hamulgoshes. Those are the senses. In other words, we gather information through our sight, through our hearing, through touching, through tasting, through inhaling. We gather information by virtue of our senses. A second is what he calls hamikuboles. That is tradition or transmission. Transmission would probably be more accurate, because mikuboles includes things that, for example, we read in the newspaper. Now, we didn't see these events with our own eyes. We get them by virtue of the fact that someone else saw them or experienced them, and they report to us. So any form of reporting becomes a source of information that falls under that second category. The information is transmitted to us. The third is called hamifusamais, the well-known. That would include the fact that we accept certain things by virtue of the fact that they are so widely accepted. Examples that he gives is that there, for example, that there was once a country such as Babylonia or Greece. Now, none of us personally experience Greece or Babylonia. And the reason that we know that they existed is by virtue of the fact that there are texts in history, and that we have some measure of trust to the fact that this information is so widespread that it can hardly be that someone pulled over a big fraud and that they concocted the idea that there was a place called Greece. He also includes in that certain assumptions, such as acts of loving kindness are good and stealing is bad. Few people question those assumptions. Those are assumptions which have become part of the fabric of mankind's basic value structure, because of the experience is so widely spread that people accept these by virtue of the fact that they are mifusamis, that they are so widely known. He has a category which is called muskoles harishenes. Those are kind of obvious facts. That would be, for example, that the whole is greater than the part. I mean, it's obvious. A young child whose intellect is not fully developed understands that the whole is greater than the part. And that is makes up a whole category of information which are obvious facts. A fifth is that he identifies is mathematical truths. These he calls mofes chotech. These are very clear and demonstrable expressions of logic. The next is called raya, which he talks about in terms of evidential proof. In other words, there are sources of information which lead us to make certain conclusions which are not at all clear on the surface, but which we string together, which we make certain inferences about that tell us that some things happen. That might be circumstantial evidence in court, but all of the many, many different ways in which we reach conclusions on the basis of circumstances every day in our lives. And the seventh is meifes nikne, which is philosophical. Philosophical information which comes to us on the basis of philosophical proof. He goes at great length to speak about the reliability of all of these, and any of these individually. He was well schooled in the philosophers, from the earliest philosophers to the philosophers of his own time, including Leibniz and Kant and Hume, and addresses some of their criticisms of philosophy, which themselves demonstrate the fact that philosophical proofs are not reliable. And so he ultimately comes back to the fact that in the second category, that which is called mikubales, those things which come to us by virtue of transmission or report from others, that there are 17 levels of reliability, the highest of which is represented by the transmission of the Jewish faith and its origins. We might begin simply by saying that to know that there is a God, which is the first principle, should be a basic and almost reflexive response to the universe in which we live. Our basic logic, our fundamental nature is that whenever we see order, that we seek an author to that order. That whenever we see structure and discipline, whenever we see logic, design, that we immediately say to ourselves, there must be a source to this design. That fundamental reflex to seek a source or an author, an architect for design is really one of the things that every person should normally do when they look at our world. And there are numerous, throughout the history of philosophy, numerous such presentations and demonstrations, fundamental, very elaborate, simple and complex, which summon us to accept the fact that there must be a creator to our universe, if for no other reason than there is too much order that we could allow this order to be attributed to chance. And by the way, there are a number of current works which are of great interest. All of whose titles, by the way, escape me at the moment. I will try to record those titles and bring them to your attention. They make up some very easy and very compelling reading. Permission to Believe is one of them. There's another one, fairly recent volume, which is, it's sitting on my desk. doesn't help you a lot, but it is. It is peculiar that when you have something which is so clear and so evident, so that it governs every other response and every other aspect of our lives, that when it comes to religion, that we subject it to an enormous array of very unusual critical assessment. And the preponderance of argument or argumentation and disputation about whether or not we can feel comfortable accepting a God in our universe whose the proof of which is cause and effect has come under such fire that despite the fact that our entire lives are governed by cause and effect, when it comes to religion, there's a chasm. And there we say, prove it to me. We don't live on the edge of such insanity in any other area of life. But when it comes to accepting an authority over our lives, which, as we will see, must follow if we are logically inclined thinkers, from the fact that the universe has a creator rather than is a product of some cosmic accident, that regardless of whatever other aspect of life we would address with cause and effect, when it comes to religion, we stop. And there we say the argument is not sufficiently compelling. Let's set that aside for a moment. And let's talk about why Jews believe. Jews believe, in a way, and it's important that we note this, the origins of our faith are such that the Judaic faith is based upon a beginning which makes it categorically different, categorically superior than the beginnings of any other faith structure with which we are generally familiar. Now, I know that is chauvinistic, and that may sound like a very bold statement, but I believe that it will become very clear in the next short period of time why this is so. There is a if we were to have someone report to us about a certain occurrence, and we accepted their report indiscriminately, it would be foolish of us. That we should exercise some discretion about who it is that is reporting to us. Is that person reliable? Does that person, even if they are reliable, does that person care about whether or not my information, maybe he's not telling me the truth. If I can be convinced of the fact that this person cares about me, then I need to be certain about that person's integrity. If I can be certain about that person's integrity, I need to be certain about that person's wisdom. How do I know that they were not deceived or misled in whatever they perceived or whatever they're reporting to me? If I can assume that these are people who would have subjected whatever it is that they wish to report to me to an extraordinary number of tests, I would nonetheless have to know whether or not that person may have at the time been under the influence of. Do I know whether or not they were in full command or control of all of their critical senses? Do I know whether or not someone who maybe would have been wiser or more inclined to be investigative might have come up with different conclusions. Is information which is reported to me by a single individual capable of standing up to information which is reported to me to the contrary by someone who may be of similar integrity? How do I decide when I am caught between a number of conflicting reports? And if, in fact, I'm caught between conflicting reports, does it make a difference that in one instance the information is transmitted to me by a single individual and in the other instance it's transmitted to me by many individuals? Do I know, for example, that these many individuals could not have been deceived? Many of you have perhaps had occasion to watch some of the masters of contemporary magic who perform illusions which are of staggering proportions. And how do we convince ourselves that there has not been an illusion perpetrated upon these people who are reporting to us? Jewish faith is not based upon an event which took place secretly, an event which took place with a single individual who then comes to us and reports to us that they are the beneficiaries of some prophetic or divine experience which revealed to them whatever information about God or about their particular function. It is not transmitted to us in a fashion which should leave us with some question about the intent or the sincerity or the interest in our well-being that these people have transmitted to us this information is. It begins with a national prophetic experience. National meaning that at this experience, at this revelation, this point in which the Jewish faith begins its formal beginning, that at that moment there were some a minimum of 2 to 3 million people present, men, women, children of all ages, of all levels of intelligence, of all levels of intuition, of all levels of critical assessment. What's more, a nation who had two very important attributes. One is that this nation lived in a land of, that is, that for centuries they lived in a land which was particularly endowed and gifted with the capacity to create illusion, or who practiced or who lived in an environment in which all forms of sorcery and occult magic took place. These were not, when Moshe came initially to perform in front of the Pharaoh his, so to speak, his bag of tricks, in which the staff which he carried in his hand turned into a snake. The Pharaoh greeted him with derision and ridicule. He scoffed at him. He said, "Are you bringing sorcery to Egypt, the land of sorcery? Are you bringing illusion to Egypt, the land of illusion?" I mean, it was laughable to the Pharaoh, and he, of course, immediately summoned his sorcerers to perform those identical acts. And however it was demonstrated that Moses' sorcery was greater, nonetheless, we deal with the mentality of a people who were subjected to, who were aware of the fact that it is possible to create events which are of supernatural, at least impress one as being beyond the natural, beyond the ordinary, and in light of which, the experience of revelation would have been subjected to their critical faculties of having lived in a land which was full of illusions, which was full of extraordinary events, and allowed them to challenge their experience by virtue of the fact that they were accustomed to the events which were extraordinary. How do we know that this is real? How do we know that God appeared to us? How do we know that whatever it is that addressed us was in fact the divine? Perhaps this was merely a product of the great ability of Moses to continue those wondrous events which he orchestrated in Egypt. So number one, the experience at Sinai had to stand up to the criticism and the discrimination of the people who were steeped in an environment of sorcery and illusion. Second of all, is the nature of the people themselves. Israel, throughout their certainly their early national conduct, and I think it's fair to say throughout history, have been a contentious people. Moses, who liberated them from wholesale destruction, from genocide, from the murder of their children, from the cruelty and the brutality of their work, from the indignity of their bondage, was nonetheless time and again assaulted by this contentious people, not fully trusting him, not fully accepting what he had to say to them, constantly contesting what he had to say. By nature, we are a critical people. By nature, we are a people who challenges everything. And finally, that this was not merely a revelation which gave them some sort of a definition of the way in which the universe came into being and the fact that there was a God. Were that it alone, we might yet even today, even accepting Israel's contentiousness and its exposure to an environment of sorcery, we would even today leave or have certain lingering doubts. Why not? Why shouldn't they accept this monotheistic, unseen God? What does it cost? What is its price? What does it demand? Well, the demands were extensive, because along with this revelation came an entire Torah, an entire discipline, which made extensive demands on human conduct. It invaded the privacy of people in the most exhaustive way. In ways, by the way, that go far beyond anything that we have to contend with today. Because in addition to the fact that our own lives today are governed from the moment that we wake until the time that we go to sleep, so that every move needs to conform, we need to ask ourselves, does this conform to the divine will? at every given moment in time, what is our responsibility to the divine expectation? When we sit down to eat, and when we sit down to talk to our friends, is this Lashon Hara? Is this Rechilus? Is this Dvarim Betelim? Are these injurious forms of speech? Do we have a right to say these things? It kind of complicates normal social discourse. It makes demands upon us when we're in the bathroom so that we conduct ourselves modestly. It makes demands upon us in our most intimate relationship with our spouse. There is, in every which way, there are demands which are made of us. And when we go into the business world, it does not allow us to make, to present our merchandise in ways which are in the least way deceiving. We cannot misrepresent. When we advertise, we have to engage in advertising which is consistent with Jewish law. When a word is given, a word must be honored. When you compete for a job, you must be very, very careful about whether or not the conditions under which you compete with someone else for a job conform to what is allowable. When you sell any kind of an item, it's the amount of profit which you're allowed to take is governed by Jewish law. When you make a loan, whether or not you're allowed to take interest is governed by Jewish law. If you're a farmer, then there are a whole host of laws that apply. And in addition to the fact that they had all of these things, many of which don't affect us because we don't, many of us don't live in an agrarian society, there were the laws of Tuma and Tahara, the laws of ritual, acceptability, unacceptability, the kinds of the contamination or defilement, which allowed us to interact not only with certain segments of the community, but could have an effect on the way in which we dealt with the objects in our own home. Were we allowed to touch the bread or not touch the bread? Or were we allowed to come in contact with certain things at certain times or not? So it was a simultaneous with this faith came an enormous demand, which, if anything, would have invoked all of these extreme sensitivities, which were a product at once of the natural Jewish contentiousness, and secondly, of their exposure to the fact that sorcery can be responsible for many of the things that we see. That the moment that it was concluded, and the initial exhilaration, the initial excitement, the initial ecstasy over this experience had begun to wane, and people found themselves now living with this law day in and day out, something which step after step made demands upon them, invaded their privacy, caused them to live with the sense that no moment was free of this divine providence and divine regulation. Their eagerness to throw off this yoke, were it only subject to being renounced or rejected, would have been a drive of such gargantuan force that our faith would not have survived more than a couple of days. But here was a faith which was based upon an experience which was confirmed by millions of people to each other, so that the origin of this experience was such that throughout the length and breadth of these millions of people, that everyone could confirm that every aspect of what had taken place was not capable of being dismissed, that it could not be renounced or rejected on the basis of sorcery, that it was beyond that rejection, that its validity and the nature of that revelation was so compelling, so clear, that it had to stand as a fact which could no more be dismissed than one could dismiss the reality of their own being. So this is not someone who comes down from a mountain and says, guess what? I just had a divine revelation. This is a nation that states for themselves, to one another, and ultimately to those whom they would least betray, their children. Those whom they care most about, those to whom they would wish to impart the greatest amount of felicity and happiness, those to whom, if one could choose amongst all relationships in human experience, the ones who would be least likely to be betrayed by an untruth, that entire generation of millions transmitted their experience to their children and their children's children, and so it has gone from generation to generation. When we speak about ma'amin, I believe what we are talking about at the very most basic level is that having reflected upon the origins of our faith, that we believe all those generations who have come before us, who have been the bearers of this experience. It may be true that in certain instances, such as our own generations, that we skip a link in the chain. There are some, I should say, considerable number of homes in which that experience has not been transmitted. But we can skip one generation. In our own personal case, and go back to our grandparents or our great-grandparents, most certainly we can go back to the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of others who were recipients to that tradition to which our ancestors were privy throughout the ages and plug into it that way. Nonetheless, what we are coming back to ultimately is that we believe the tradition and the transmission which goes back to that founding event which told us about the Almighty. Now, we'll have to talk about what did it tell us about the Almighty in a moment. The question that I would like to raise is the question to which we alluded to earlier, namely the fact that we are finite and God is infinite. So how do we explain the fact that an infinite God was able to reveal himself, to reveal his presence to those who were finite? How is that possible?
Because
believed as a contradiction which is absurd, and which then says to us, well, we know that it happened, but at the very least, I cannot explain how it happened and must attribute that to faith. So I'd like to develop at least some clear perception of why this is possible. Let us begin with an admission that if we have an infinite God who is omnipresent, who is everywhere at all times, then it really becomes impossible for us to deal with the fact that in that omnipresence that there should be anything which is finite whatever. In other words, if everything is infinite, now I'm not being pantheistic here, pantheism sees the infinite as being there is no such thing as the finite. Everything is God. Man is God. Dirt is God. Everything is God. Because this problem of the clash between the finite and the infinite becomes one that they cannot resolve. That's pantheism. But Judaism recognizes that the infinite is, in fact, infinite, and that God created the finite world within himself by obscuring his infinitude, so that things came into being by the Almighty creating within himself something that would not be aware of its connection to the infinite. Everything must be part of the infinite, which is the all-encompassing presence of God. But when God created this world, he created it in a series of emanations which progressively screened out or obscured its awareness of its connection of that fabric. So, for example, a rock cannot exist other than because of its connection to the infinite. If for one moment the Almighty were to remove that entire chain of emanation which allows the rock to come into being, then it would cease to exist. Human being generally is unaware of his connection to the infinite because we are very much aware of ourselves, the demands that our finite selves make. What transpired at Sinai was the fact that the human being, you will remember, is created in the image of God. The definition of that is that in the human being there is a bridge that God invested, unlike the rock, in which there is no such bridge, unlike the tree, the blossom, the blade of grass, the drop of water, unlike the fox or the ox, unlike any of those beings, in the human being, he put in part of himself, which is the capacity for that which is infinite, that which is finite and connected to the infinite, but finite by obscurity, to connect up with the infinite so that that barrier dissolves. The barrier between that which makes us aware that we are separate and distinct, which allows us to come into being as separate, that there is something which then connects up with the infinite. In other words, there is something infinite in man which is capable of being that bridge that transmits the infinite experience. Now, if I were to distribute amongst you here some aromatic spices, and you would inhale the aroma of these aromatic spices, and then I would say to you, let's say they were cloves, whatever, I would say to you, describe that experience. And you would begin to describe, well, it's a very pleasant smell. Well, I never inhaled any cloves, so I don't know what that means. So I would say, pleasant like ice cream, pleasant like sugar, pleasant like honey, pleasant like whatever, other, pleasant. Pleasant like something warm on your skin. Whatever my pleasant experiences would be, I would try to, and you would be groping for words. No. It's something which, when you inhale it, it has kind of a certain sweetness about it, but not sweetness like sugar. We would grope. And ultimately, we would have to admit that there's no way we can communicate to someone else what a sweet aroma really is. There's no way that we would be able to differentiate between the way a rose or a lilac blossom smells as opposed to a clove. Those are somewhat ineffable experiences. Nonetheless, the beneficiary, the beholder of that experience, knows in an indisputably clear way that they have experienced something which is very pleasant and very, and which they could recognize again in any context. This experience, this revelatory experience, which took place at Sinai, which took place through this medium, which is the soul of man, which is the spark of the divine, left upon every finite/infinite being, man who is aware of himself, and man who can sense that they have somehow inhaled, that they have experienced something which leaves them with an indisputably clear impression. Now, it's not that it was pleasant or that it was sweet, but it was an indisputably clear impression that what just took place was a connection with a being who was infinite, who is infinite, a being who is the source of all things, a being who is absolutely perfect. The many things that we are going to find elucidated here in the Maimonides' Principles of Faith. We know these not because we have demonstrated them, argued them, proved them through any of our senses. Not because they appeal to us intuitively, not because they appeal to us aesthetically. Although all of those sources certainly should be brought into being in some kind of a chorus, some kind of a symphony, which all of which comes to strengthen our experience. But Jewish faith is first and foremost predicated upon the experience at Sinai, which left us with a very clear appreciation of all the things that we are going to learn about, or virtually all of the things that we're going to learn about, because there are some other very important sources of information. But left us with the basics of our faith in an indisputably clear way, which we have since tried to transmit from generation to generation, indicating that they are the most important and significant premises of life that we can impart to our children. And yet, an experience which could not be totally committed either to record or to an oral transmission because of the fact that it was a revelation of such proportions that when the child said to his father, "Well, how did you know?" or "What did it feel like?" The beholder of that revelation was left groping for words in much the same way that the inhaler of the aromatic spice cannot communicate, other than the fact that this was clearly a very sweet and pleasant experience. And the generation of Sinai, the millions at Sinai, said to their children, looked into their eyes, and said to them, "I have some things which are more important than anything else in the world. I love you, I care for you, I want you to be happy, I want your lives to be rewarding and fulfilling. I don't want you to waste your time, I don't want you to live in vain. I must impart to you these things which are unmistakably clear. They're not only clear to me, but everyone in this generation. You can go knock on any door, talk to any father, any grandfather, any mother, anyone who was there, any teacher. Confirm it for yourself 1,000,000 times, 2,000,000 times, 3,000,000 times over. Ask anyone, and you'll find out that we all experienced in the most undeniably clear way the same fundamental precepts and truths. It is clear to us that there is an infinite creator who is the source of the universe, who is the source of our being, who has created the universe with purpose, who communicates with man, and who has designated the Jewish nation as the nation that is to carry this word to the rest of the world. Ani ma'amin. I believe. The word believe means that I trust a tradition and a transmission which goes back to the most powerful religious experience in the history of all religions. There is no religion that has had the temerity, that has been so bold, so as to try to replicate in its own beginnings, to try to make any pretense to the fact that its origins took place in public, with all that accompanied Maimed HaSinai, where in fact the entire world was aware at the time that there was this kind of an experience taking place amongst so many people that each person who was present at that time was a prophet. Each one prophesied, each one was aware of the fact that they had been spoken to, that they had been addressed by the God of the universe. The word ma'amin means I believe. It's not I know, in the same way that I know that this table exists, nor is it I believe in that stupid way which requires us to deny everything which is logical or to accept indiscriminately anything that anybody would tell us. An imamin says, I believe because there is a firm basis for my belief, because there is a tradition which is at once reliable in its tradition, reliable in its source, reliable in its origin. Ani ma'amin, I believe. I am a being who has the capacity, just as those before me had the capacity, going all the way back to Sinai, to entertain a relationship with the divine, because finite though I am, there is something infinite within me which allows me and which mandates that I have a relationship with the source of my being. So we begin with those premises for Ani Ma'amin, and we will systematically progress through the 13 principles of faith. We will talk about the point of origin. We will talk about why they are so critical. And we will talk about the ways in which those things need to impact upon our lives.